AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast, here today with educational strategist Brandi Shufatinsky. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I could continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. So, ethnic studies sounds like such a warm and fuzzy concept. I learn about you, you learn about me, we foster mutual respect, tolerance, and appreciation for our cultures, traditions, and histories. Unless you're a Jew. What masquerades as a well-intentioned effort to promote coexistence and understanding within the great melting pot we call America happens to have a very dark underbelly that not only excludes, but demonizes one minority group. The one group, in fact, that is the target of more religious hate crimes than all other religions combined, despite comprising only 2% of the American population. Condescendingly branded as the uber white, uber privileged, uber oppressors, the Jewish people and the Jewish state are literally depicted in many of these ethnic studies using age-old anti-Semitic tropes and blood libels that teach our next generations to not only hate the Jews, but to march against them, to openly threaten them, and even at times to call for their death and destruction. Not so warm and fuzzy, is it? Today, Brandi Shufatinsky and I will dive deep into the cesspool of ethnic studies and critical race theory and discuss how exactly these movements that pretend to promote unity and understanding actually radicalize our next generations with divisive and hateful rhetoric. So Brandi Shufatinsky is a social worker, writer, and researcher working to counter the illiberal takeover of our education system. Dr. Shufatinsky has been published in Newsweek, Jewish Journal, the Jerusalem Post, Sapir, White Rose Magazine, and JNS. She was a 2021 scholar in residence at the Institute for the Study of Global Antisemitism and Policy, Oxford Summer Institute, where she worked to develop curriculum in critical anti-Semitism studies. Brandi, thank you so much for joining us today. We have so much to learn from you.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's dive in. So as with so many DEI programs, there's a lot of confusion about what ethnic studies is and what it isn't. So in my estimation, what it is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and the sheeple are too complicit to question its content or its intentions. So we'll deep dive into the undercurrents of these studies, but first, can you start off by explaining just simply at face value, what is ethnic studies and what is its stated intention?
Sure. Before I do want to apologize. I mentioned I'm getting over a cough, so hopefully you'll be able to understand me clearly and I won't have a coughing attack. So I think that you really pointed out one of the biggest misconceptions about what ethnic studies is. When most people hear ethnic studies, they think it's the study of different ethnic groups. And in a country that's pluralistic, unlike the United States, that sounds great. That, you know, kids in class, it would be beneficial for them to learn about all of the different types of people and communities that have not just make up our country, but that have contributed to the building of our country and will hopefully continue to its betterment. That's not what ethnic studies is. Ethnic studies as a discipline is not the study of different ethnic groups. It's the study of power, and it's the study of oppression. I usually refer to it as oppression studies. So the groups that are deemed the most oppressed are privileged as far as what, how much space they take up, how much learning should be focused on those groups. And the groups that have been labeled as oppressors get relegated to the dustbin of history. So they don't, through this discipline, they're not viewed worthy of studying. And so they get dismissed. Now this, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So we're going to go so deep into this, but just to take one step back, let's pretend that you are Coates or Kendi and you want to sell. How about that? You want to, or in some objective fashion, say this is the intention of this program, so that we have a baseline.
Sure.
To dive off of.
Sure. So usually ethnic studies is sold as marginalized ethnic groups and communities in the United States have had their experiences and histories ignored in favor of a more Eurocentric or white-centric history. So ethnic studies gives an opportunity for those stories and experiences to be highlighted. And then it gives children that are from those communities or students that are from those communities an opportunity to see themselves in their curricula. And the kids that do that do better. That's the argument made by the folks that are for ethnic studies being taught in school.
And a bit of foreshadowing, I'm going to guess by that last sentence, that these kids are not doing better. Is that accurate?
I think it's accurate to say. And I also, I mean, which I'm sure we'll get into, but the data that's used to make that argument is based on a flawed research. So, but I'll set that aside for now.
Okay, there's so much to set aside because there's just so many levels to this story. Okay, so let's go ahead when it goes to levels and stacking on DEI. There's also on top of DEI, which I think because Trump really brought that to the forefront, I think most people more or less understand that. But there's been a lot of debate and discussion around critical social justice and its ideological component, critical race theory, otherwise known as CRT. But again, few people really know what this is actually about. So can you give us an overview? What is critical race theory and how fundamental is it to ethnic studies? Can it be decoupled?
So if I want to take a step back and look a little bit just at critical theory, which, okay. So if we focus on critical race theory, that's just one component of critical theory, which holds that the disparities that we see between groups, whether that's between racial groups or whether that's between folks that face disabilities and folks that are able-bodied, whatever the middle letter kind of is, the critical theory holds that those disparities exist because of some form of discrimination that's been institutionalized. So when we look at a discipline like ethnic studies, that is oppression studies, well, ethnic studies depends on the acceptance of the idea that disparity is due to discrimination and not individual agency or any form of individuality. When we look at some DEI programs, they seem to depend on the same type of idea. Only those deemed worthy are included. Only those stories and experiences are taught. And in order to be seen as worthy, you have to be properly labeled as having been oppressed, which falls directly in line with critical theory.
Which is so interesting because in essence, it removes all aspects of merit, like of earning what you work for. And so what happens in a society where accomplishment is no longer something to be celebrated, but rather something to be frowned upon, then now we're creating this sort of race to the bottom. I mean, you can see in the way that the world is using the word elite, and I know it's very nuanced as like a negative thing, but 20 years ago, Elite meant the top of the top, the creme de la creme, right? Like the people who really worked hard to get to where they wanted to go. And now we've turned our most accomplished students, let's say in the framework of K to 12, into apologists.
That's correct. And I think that the phrase that I'm used to hearing and that I've used before is oppression Olympics. In order to win the gold medal in the oppression Olympics, you have to be sufficiently oppressed. And in order to do that, you can't then achieve, because achievement would fly in the face of oppression. I do want to say, though, that I find that the pendulum swings pretty hard. And right now, you know, what's led to things like ethnic studies requirements and some DEI programs being implemented has been a reaction to an idea that merit is the one solution for everything. There are people that work hard. There are students that work very hard, and they won't achieve a certain level of success simply because they don't have access that other students have. That is a fact. That doesn't mean that the result of that disparity is systemic racism, or that they will always fail and not succeed because they don't in this point. So I also don't want to give the impression that racism hasn't occurred, or discrimination hasn't occurred, or just bad luck hasn't occurred in situations where students, even working hard, are unable to achieve.
Of course, and not only has it occurred, but we can't deny that it is a piece of the, you know, American story. However, it's not unique to America. It's a piece of story. I mean, go back to the Bible and it existed. You know, we weren't the only ones doing slavery. During the times of slavery, everybody was doing it. Does it make it okay? No, but is it still going on in sub-Saharan Africa? Actually, yes. So I think that there's this sense that you of like an intractable connection to your history, that there's no way to transcend it, no matter what you do to build a better society. It's never going to be enough because your ancestors, which may not even have been your ancestors. I mean, so many people came to America in whatever, this generation, the last generation, the generation before that, and weren't even a party to this, even if we are white. So let's go one time deeper. I know that I just said we're going to stack, but I think that is the opposite of stacking once we start getting into this, because it's sort of ugly. Because ultimately, so critical theory, we'll say critical theory rather than CRT, which thank you for clearing that up, and ethnic studies are actually both based in Marxist theory, which is predicated on the revolutionary overthrow of capitalist society. Again, a very far cry from let's understand each other's cultures and histories. Are ethnic studies separable from Marxism? And like, so let's get very specifically. We talked about sort of what ethnic studies are or is, but what are both the stated and unstated goals of ethnic studies, specifically vis-a-vis American society, values, and our capitalist structure?
Honestly, I mean, I think that most of the goals are pretty clearly stated. If folks are listening, they don't, the proponents of ethnic studies don't hide their goals to critique and or dismantle our system of government, our economic system, our social order. That isn't really hidden. The critiques that are listed, to critique the cis heteropatriarchy, to critique empire, to critique capitalism, to critique white supremacy, those things are pretty well highlighted, even in the folks that are peddling ethnic studies in the K through 12 school system. So I don't find that it's really hidden. And really, when you look at some of the commonalities between Marxist ideology and ethnic studies as a discipline, it comes down to the erasure of the individual. So if you fit into this racial category, then you have to abide by these standards, these ways of life, this way of thinking. And if you fall outside of that, you're no longer a member of this identity box. So it's the erase of the individual and replacing the individual with community or with the collective.
Okay, so let me clarify my use of the word hidden. A lot of people don't understand the Hamas charter, for example. It's on the internet. Anybody who cares could find it, right? And understand what it's about. So the people in my community, right? So I'm in West LA. This is the hotbed of all things, you know, like whatever, ethnic studies. The parents, I would hazard to guess, do not think of ethnic studies as being Marxist, as overthrowing our capitalist society, as revolutionizing against the society and values that we live in. So I guess that's what I mean by hidden. It's hidden in plain view, but who's doing the digging?
Groups like Navi, groups like there are groups that are looking into it and doing the digging. But I think the hidden in plain sight part comes from a play on words. So ethnic studies is a play on words. If you hear ethnic studies, it sounds like one thing that I think most decent people would be in favor of. What also happens is you hear this bait and switch. So you'll hear, oh, they're against ethnic studies. That's because they don't want kids to learn Black history.
Right.
Ethnic studies has nothing to do with Black history. Black history is its own discipline. And so that bait and switch tends to work pretty well with decent people that would not be against kids learning Black history. In fact, they'd be highly in favor of it. Who wants to be called or thought of as being a racist or against learning about the contribution that Chinese Americans made when they first started coming to this country and their experiences and the battles and obstacles that they faced? Most decent people think, yeah, of course kids should learn that because that's part of our story. That's part of American history. So people think that that's what ethnic studies is. It's not. It clearly isn't. The ethnic studies activists say that that's not what it is. They'll say ethnic studies is not multicultural studies. They'll say ethnic studies is not the study of ethnicities. They're pretty clear about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that the parents need to be educated along with the children, and that I wish, but I'm jumping way ahead, but I wish there was a mechanism where parents could get the curriculum and go, yeah, we're opting out of this. The fact that it's mandatory instead of, like you're saying, incorporating this into American history, which is where it belongs, instead of as a social study, should be an option for parents. In the conversation about good and decent people, wow. Okay, we'll get into that as well. So let me ask a question though. So I'm going to assume that among the people who actually do know what the intentions very clearly and content of these programs is the government. So I guess my next question is, like, why would our government, whether they're local, state, or national, be complicit in education that actually subverts our own American interests and, in my opinion, threatens our very future?
I don't think that they're aware of it. I think that they've fallen for the bait and switch. I don't think most elected officials, most that support ethnic studies or want to implement some form of guardrails or, oh, just make sure you include this community also, I don't think that they understand the fundamentals of the discipline.
Do they want?
I mean, some of them, hopefully, maybe. Many of them are worried and afraid of what it looks like to stand against something that so easily can be so easily misconstrued into, oh, you're just racist, or, oh, you're just whatever other slur, you know, bad word that people, you know, again, most decent people don't want to be seen as. So whether they're willfully ignorant or just ignorant, I'm not sure. But the things that are suggested to fix ethnic studies that I've seen, at least so far, especially in the state of California, are only fixes that would be proposed by people that just have a misunderstanding about what the subject is and what the discipline is.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch that even the Jewish caucus within our state legislature is rooting essentially for a resolution on this that does not serve the Jewish population at all. But I'm going to get into that in a minute. But before that, sticking with California, not just because I'm here, but because this is the epicenter of everything. Like just a few weeks ago, right, the California Commission on the State of Hate concluded that the state's ethnic studies, and I'm going to quote this, lacks accountability, promotes ideological activism, and fosters division. So even overlooking the fact that we need a commission on the state of hate to monitor ethnic studies, okay, that fact is telling enough. Can you clarify how exactly ethnic studies drives wedges between different sectors of society? And more specifically, can we start to talk about the actual anti-Semitic and anti-Israel undertones and overtones that characterize these classes?
Sure. Do you remember when, I can't remember which decade it was, but an experiment was done with students, and it was like the brown eyes, blue eyes experiment.
There was a movie about that called The Wave.
Right. Yes. Well, that's what ethnic studies is. That's what the state is mandating. There are groups that based on their immutable characteristics that are deemed the good guys, and groups that are deemed the bad guys. And that's what, so looking at how does it foment division and hate? Well, that way. This experiment was done decades ago, and
Yeah.
we saw how it played out in the classroom. So it should surprise no one that we're seeing the same type of thing play out in the classroom, only this time it's government sponsored. It's been institutionalized in the states and in the school districts that have required this class for kids to graduate and earn their high school diploma.
Okay, for those who are not familiar with this experiment, I know it inside out. I've been talking because we watched this in the 80s. It was so mandatory for all Jewish youth groups. Like we watched it many times. Like every year they'd be like, "And now the wave," right? But even kids who are 2 or 3 decades younger than I are not familiar with this story at all. Could you explain what happened?
Sure. Actually, I'm gonna I'll let you jump in and clarify because I'll give a brief overview. I saw it in elementary school. We talked about it in, I think, social studies. So,
Yeah.
there were kids. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I thought you said you wanted me to. Go for it.
Please, please go ahead.
So basically, it was a high school teacher in middle America. He was teaching the Holocaust. His students couldn't understand how it happened. So he had this idea for an experiment where every day, little by little, he would give privileges to a certain class of children based, as you said, on their eye color. So, like maybe one day, everybody with whatever blue eyes got an apple. And at first, people were like, wait, what? Like, why do they get an apple and I don't get an apple? And then each day he would stack on that until they always get the ball and handball and they get to go first in line for whatever. And eventually, what happened was the kids who in this non-privileged class just went ahead and fell back and let it happen. And the big reveal at the end of the movie, at least, was he has the whole school in the auditorium, and he says, because he literally built a Hitler youth proletariat, he says, "I'm now going to turn you over to your new leader because, I'm just a whatever, a soldier of this whatever." He turns on the film, it's Hitler, and suddenly the kids are like, "Oh." They didn't see it coming. They didn't see it happening. They didn't see how they fell for the whole thing.
Exactly. And I mean that's what we're seeing happen. And one of the indicators that you mentioned, it would be great if parents could see the curriculum and maybe opt out if they didn't want to. But if you look through ethnic studies curricula, and I've looked at dozens of them, many of them from the state, different school districts throughout the state of California, you'll see that the first unit in the semester-long or year-long course is identity. And so it goes through and asks students to put themselves in identity boxes. And then it assigns a value to it. And even if that value isn't necessarily explicit, it's similar to the blue eyes, brown eyes experiment, to where it's little things, little privileges, whether it's an apple or putting on, looking at your identity. And so do you check the number of boxes that we're listing here to see how privileged you are? It's the same type of experiment being done on our kids and now mandated by our elected officials.
And they make it into this fun, at least some of them do, mandala, color in the thing. And, you know, so the kids are excited about, yes, I'm oppressed in this way, or, oh no, I'm privileged in this way. Literally creating a hierarchy. And we see what happens in hierarchical societies. I mean, not just, obviously the parallels to Nazi Germany are inescapable, but even if one looks at India and the caste system, it's horrifying how the untouchables, I mean, every single day they are treated to this day like the Jews of Nazi Germany. And this is what happens when everything is about, like, where are you on this pyramid? And now I guess that the main goal is just to invert the pyramid, but it still creates an oppressive hierarchical society wherein eventually, you talked about the pendulum swinging, eventually we're going to have to go back and go, oh, the white people are oppressed and now we need to, you know, come back and the masculine men have been oppressed. And like, where does this even end?
And I think that that's the fundamental question I have with everything are we playing a game of, oh, it was your turn last century, so it's my turn this century? And is that the game we actually want to play with our kids?
Yeah, exactly. I'm thinking this has nothing to do with K-12 education, but I'm thinking of the videos that came out right after George Floyd about these white women who were kissing the boots of black men. And it's like, okay, this may be a bridge too far. Okay. Yeah. So there's been sort of a delineation when it comes to critical social justice of these sort of like seven pillars, right, that specifically fuel anti-Semitism. I'm going to just touch upon them really quickly. I'm not even going to touch upon them. I'm just going to list them. So we've got the canard of Jewish privilege, the erasure of Jewish identity, intersectionality and anti-Semitism, the anti-Israel binary, marginalizing Jews in politics, Jews and equity, and undermining Enlightenment principles. Now, I would say that a lot of these concepts are untenable to the average listener. I even had to look into each one because I'm like, wait, what? But can you give some specific examples of anti-Semitic content within the ethnic studies framework and maybe tie them into one or more of these elements as sort of a depiction of how this plays out?
Sure. And I'll try to be a little bit just like plain speak, not academic speak.
Okay, plain speak rocks.
Yeah. So one of the ways that it plays out in anti-Semitism is erasure of Jewish identity. So we will see Jews either disregarded as an ethno-religious people, which many people aren't familiar with what it means to be an ethno-religious group of people, and Jews are an ancient people, so we predate the racial color-based racial identities that people usually use when they describe folks in the United States and other places in the West. But the erasure happens in multiple ways. One, it's the anti-Zionist narrative. So the erasure of Jewish peoplehood as a people that come from the land of that is now Israel. The depiction of Jews as white or European. So not as part of a European diaspora, but as having become a people in Europe, which Jews didn't. Jews are from Judea, from Israel. And then the idea that in any real or perceived success, and this is the Jewish privilege, hits on the Jewish privilege piece, was ill-gotten. So only achieved through the exploitation of others. So when we look at the United States, and this isn't to say that all Jews are privileged or all Jews come from wealth, but when you look in a place like the United States, by and large, Jewish Americans have done well here. And as such a small minority group are overrepresented in certain spaces of quote unquote success, whether it's academic or scientific or artistic, you'll find the Jews are as a overall very generally overrepresented. Well, if one believes that success is only achieved through exploitation, then that is it's a pretty short hop then to believe that, well, if Jews are overrepresented in this privileged group, the only way they got there was through the ultimate exploitation of others. So that ideology fuels that trope that leans into the trope of Jewish privilege.
And again, with the concept of intersectionality and the mandala and all the, you know, where do we fit in all this? So let me ask a personal question. You are, for anybody who's listening to this on podcast rather than watching on YouTube and who may not be familiar with you, you are a Black Jewish woman. So where does that put you on the hierarchy, and where where does this sense of activism come from? I mean, how do you decide? Like, when I say who are you, I don't mean that, but I'm saying that if they're going to force this paradigm on every single person, according to them, who are you? Where is your place in this society?
Well, I mean, I could tell you some of the slurs I get on like private messages on social media, but I'll avoid that. I think that many other people, many other Jews who don't fit into whatever box that our opposition, for lack of a better descriptor, puts us in, we either get silenced, ignored, or, oh, you're conditionally this. So that is actually a concept that comes out of critical social justice ideology, conditional whiteness. It's applied to Jews, it's applied to Asians, it's applied to Nigerians, it's applied to some groups of people that don't fit into the narrative of, because we're a minority, an ethnic minority or a racial minority, then we have to be oppressed. So those group, that ideology labels those folks as being conditionally white. For me, I think, and many other Black Jews, Ethiopian Jews, many other Black Jews hear the same thing, that well, how could you agree with that? Or how could you be a Zionist? You should be on this side. And that's coming from folks who accept the idea that the only way to be Black is in their way, which that in itself is bigoted.
Sure. How do they reconcile the outsized success of the Nigerian population, who you can't even call white adjacent in America?
Oh, but the terms are, conditional whiteness has nothing to do with color. It has to do with ideology. And this is where it gets. So
it's not because most Jewish people
appear
right. Again, like, people don't even understand, like, Mizrahi Jews, come to my synagogue in LA where everyone is Persian, and you'll be like, wait, what? Jews? But they can be labeled as, what would be the term, be white adjacent, just because they've been successful in this world?
And the same with Black Americans who may have success, right? Because the idea is that success, not the color, is whiteness. Being on time is whiteness. Loving to read and write is whiteness. That's an ideology, and I think it's difficult sometimes to talk about or explain because it sounds so crazy, and it is.
Yeah. Okay, again, when I say that this is super layered for people who are just getting into this, it goes so much deeper. So let's talk a little bit about, I think that particularly as a yoga instructor in the world of love and light that has turned rapidly anti-Semitic and frighteningly violent towards me, I just wake up every day, my head hurts thinking like what happened to this concept of no place Great. Like, how do the authors of this ethnic studies coursework reconcile their overt racism with their supposed anti-racism?
I mean, Kendi wrote it himself that the remedy for, you know, past discrimination is current discrimination. And I think he tried to clean it up multiple times, but he wrote what he wrote. The other part of it is that there are certain behaviors and ideas that are just being seen as justified.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the idea that because this group has achieved success through the exploitation of others, they deserve for us to throw tomatoes at them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, virtual tomatoes. They deserve it. We saw that after October 7th, actually, pretty immediately. We saw people in the phrase always resistance is justified. It was pretty a switch that was turned pretty quickly and pretty easily by people who believe these ideologies, that any group of people or individual deserves something bad to happen to them because of their very identity.
Okay, so you mentioned 10/7, which is a moment in time that definitely changed history forever. But I do want to point out to listeners, again, who are not familiar, that this anti-Semitic and anti-Israel ethnic studies content predates the current Gaza war by years. Okay, so just for anybody who's like, yeah, well, I don't even want to say the word, whatever is going on in Gaza, it's not even about that. This was years ago. So why the Jews? Why are there, is it, I mean, I can't, maybe I'm blind. I don't see this happening with any other group on earth. There's so much anger towards the Jewish people, particularly since we have throughout modern history stood for every minority and stood in solidarity with every social justice cause imaginable. Like, I understand it's got to go beyond oppressed oppressor, because we don't see mobs of tens or hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets to just kill the white people who are the ultimate oppressor. This is about the Jews. So Brandy, there's got to be a place, like, where did this hate come from? And when did it actually take root in the K-12 education system?
So I see this a little bit differently than you just expressed. I don't think that it's only about the Jews. I think that anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish bigotry in the ethnic studies, in the education space, I think that we are the first wave.
Yes.
I think that we're quickly seeing the second wave that's coming in, crashing on the shore right now, has been pretty anti-American, anti-Western civilization. And that followed really, really quickly. So but also I want to say it depends on which anti-Jewish group you're talking about. If you're talking about the neo-Marxists and the communists, well, they've always been anti-Jewish for multiple reasons, whether that's the inability to generalize Jewish identity,
mm-hmm.
whether it's been the fact that Jews, even under the most oppressive communist regimes, have still been able to hold on to parts of Jewish peoplehood, whether that was religious based, whether that was the expression of Zionism as identity. But even the harshest communist Marxist conditions couldn't erase that. Now, whether it's coming from the Islamist anti-Jewish groups, we can explain that through religious ideological based hate, through Arab supremacist anti-Jewish bigotry, which has existed for centuries. And what we're seeing in the United States in the education space is that those two things meld, this red-green alliance come together and foment a lot of the anti-Jewish bigotry that we're seeing in education.
Mm-hmm. And when did this start in K-12? Because there's so much talk, because it's so obvious about what's going on our college campuses, but that didn't just appear overnight. This is, I would assume, at least 20 years, at least a generation of people, young adults who have already been indoctrinated by the time they get to college.
Yeah, we have seen that. Some of the groups that have done a lot of the statistics and studies on this, I believe Stand With Us has information out on it, saw a spike in this type of rhetoric being implemented in schools after the first and second Intifada. We saw a spike of it after the 2021 war against Hamas, and we're seeing another huge spike of it after the October 7th invasion of where Gazans and Hamas and other terrorist groups and supposed civilians infiltrated Israel and kidnapped people and slaughtered people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it, I mean, with all the religious and cultural wars and conflicts that are going on in the world, all of which, most of which, many of which, have much larger death tolls and horrifying outcomes than what's going out in Gaza. Like, why the obsession with Israel?
I think that there are multiple reasons that I've seen. One is that Israel represents the epitome of Jewish sovereignty and emancipation. We have an army now. There is a Jewish army now to protect the Jewish people worldwide, based in our indigenous homeland, in spite of the waves of people that have tried to destroy us. And so the idea of Jewish power and strength is something that upsets many people that hate Jews. They are fine with weak Jews. They're fine, like Dara Horn's written about dead Jews. But strong Jews, they have a huge problem with that.
And by the way, they're only okay with dead Jews for like a minute, as we saw on 10/7. And definitely exploded on 10/8. So I think, sadly, it's an oversimplification of the amount of sympathy that we can possibly conjure in this world. But the level, I mean, Israel is, I think, the 154th smallest country in the world. Jews represent 0.02% of the world. And yet this and I know what you're going to say. It's because of how outsized our success is and our survival. But the obsession is, it's so nonsensical, ultimately. I mean, we should, again, this comes back to the merit and, you know, elite debate of like, why don't we look up to those who have achieved what we wish to achieve instead of looking down upon them? But I agree with you about what you said is that, I mean, you didn't say it in these words, and they're very trite words at this point, but what starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews. But again, I think that even though they're burning American flags at these rallies, I think that a lot of the people think, oh yeah, we're burning American flags because America supports the Jews. Right. So I don't think they all think it's about America. It keeps coming back to the Jews.
Maybe at those protests and rallies and riots, that's the case. But what I see in K-12 especially is a very anti-American sentiment, pretty explicit one. And again, this, everybody doesn't have to wave the flag and the stars and stripes and, you know, be a patriot and everything. But there seems to be this disconnect from what is factual and what people want to think about the United States of America and the people that make up our country.
And you would want to think that education is something that's based in fact.
we would hope.
Yeah, we live in a post-factual society. That's the sad truth. So I alluded to it before, and I do want to talk specifically again about this battle that's raging here in California within our legislature, just because it really is very central to what's going to happen in the rest of the country. So I mentioned we have this AB 1468 in the state legislature, which, again, the entire Jewish caucus is actually behind, but Jewish activists and organizations are staunchly opposing in an effort to force the removal of anti-Semitic bias from these state-mandated classes. What is most eye-opening to me is that there are actually groups that are actively fighting to keep these lessons in. There are districts like Santa Ana that made national, if not international, news that literally subverted our state and the anti-bias laws in order to teach this controversial anti-Semitic content. It was so important to them. And here in LA, the teachers union had at least one meeting, I think multiple meetings, on how to fly under the radar in order to radicalize students against, I'll say, the Jewish state, but that's a nice way of saying the Jews. So here's the thing. Like, I can understand that people outside of the Jewish community, and particularly those who like don't even know Jewish people, are not fully versed on what is anti-Semitic and what isn't. But when they are being explicitly told by the Jewish community that the lessons are objectionable and their response is to dig in their heels and entrench, this is not oversight. This is a deliberate agenda. And you're in Boston, correct?
No, I'm in the Philadelphia area.
Oh, from Philadelphia. Okay. So I know that the Massachusetts Teachers Association has had a similar agenda to what's going on here, pushing extremely overt anti-Semitic tropes and even visual representations of what they call Israel, I'm putting this in quotes, and occupied Palestine. I don't think most people even realize how much bias is built into that very deliberate choice of words right there. So seeing as there's no way to micromanage hundreds of thousands of classrooms across the country, and the guardrails so far have been minimal, if existent at all, it seems. What is the best way to monitor and enforce, like, what is being taught in our K through 12 schools? Because I do believe there are, as we said in the very beginning, we meaning you, good people who do not want prejudice and bias and hate to be part of a curriculum.
No, of course there are. And I mean, there are teachers that work with kids, administrators that are responsible for the running of a school. So many of them are so well-intended and work hard, overtime, underpaid, under-resourced to do what they believe is best and what they hope is best for kids. I think that the part that concerns me is there are those who aren't well-intended, who are taking advantage of the well-intended to get their agenda through. What we're seeing in as far as guardrails, there were guardrails already put in place. So now there's a bill for another set of guardrails. Every time I ask, the first question I have is, well, who's going to enforce them? And I can't get an answer. We have a state, California has a state secretary of education. There's no answer. Who's going to enforce the guardrails? If a student knows what the guardrails are and she's sitting in class, and the teacher, the lesson, whoever violates those guardrails, and she goes home and tells her mom, hey, this is what happened in class today. Who's the mom supposed to contact? There's no answer provided from the state. Who's responsible and who's accountable? And the other piece of it is, you shouldn't have to work that hard. It's kind of one of the first rules of dating. If you're having to work that hard to make a first couple of dates work, maybe it's not worth it. What is it exactly that we're trying to achieve through this mandate that we have to go back to the drawing board time and time and time and time again? How much of California's taxpayer dollars have been wasted on this one mandate? For what purpose? Again, no answer. And I mean, those are the questions that I hope California citizens and voters consider, ask, keep in mind when they're voting for school board, keep in mind when they're voting for state legislature. Like, just keep those things in mind. Who's responsible? What are they doing with our money? And the other point I want to make is, this isn't funded. many groups, AMCA being one of the foremost, the groups that were first to say this is an unfunded mandate. If it's not funded, districts don't need to implement it, and perhaps they shouldn't, given all of the problems we've seen with it.
They don't have to, or they don't have to yet.
Correct. It's not funded. It's not a funded mandate. It's not part of the state budget. Now, there are people working to get it funded in the budget, which I think is coming out, is it in June? In California, if I remember correctly, that are working to get the governor to include money to make this mandate follow through, because as of now, it isn't. And when there have been brave district administrators that have said, you know what, it's not funded, we're not going to do it right now, we're not going to make our teachers have to teach something that they don't have funding for and make our students have to rearrange their whole schedules to take a class that isn't funded, what's happened is activists then descend upon the school board meeting and try to ram it through. And unfortunately, in some cases, they've been successful.
Right. Which it's a square peg in a round hole. Like, right. Like, ultimately, the whole system has to be dismantled. But since it seems like it's going to be plowed through, there's got to be a way to work within the system. So
maybe. I mean, I'm not. I think that parents, community members, taxpayers hold a lot more power than we live in a democracy, mm-hmm. in a representative democracy. We need to demand representation, and there are ways we have channels to do that legally and respectfully. We need to be engaged in it. And when I first started doing work with ethnic studies, I was working with a wonderful group of folks, the Alliance for Constructive Ethnic Studies. And one of the first things that we identified is that this ethnic studies is going to be used as a like wolf in sheep's clothing to get anti-Jewish bigotry institutionalized in the classroom. And that's what we've seen.
Right. I mean, that's a really nefarious goal. And I just want to take one step back about living in a democracy, because yes, we do. But at the same time, we live in within the constructs of this social media dominated world where people, quite frankly, are afraid to speak up against this forced narrative. And so it winds up on the shoulders of a very few. And I could say, oh, you know, these brave people are fighting the fight. But when you have one person who's standing up against, 50,000 people calling them, bad names, it becomes hard to find allies, first of all, who are willing to speak up, even if they're passively supportive of what we do. But also it's very hard to overcome this dominant narrative, unfortunately.
It is, especially when the dominant narrative is painting itself as the counter narrative. But I do want to say that it's easy to assume that you're the only one that feels a certain type of way. It really is to feel alone in this.
Right.
How the system is set up, it's easy to feel that way, especially you mentioned social media. We know what algorithms do, and it makes it seem like the more rational voices are the few and the other voices are the many. The other voices may have outsized power and influence, but that doesn't mean that there are more of them. And the other thing is, it's easy to frame this as only being an anti-Jewish issue. It's not. Black American kids, Black Californian students are being done a disservice by the tens of millions of dollars that have been spent on this waste of a project. Kids that are under-resourced, that have reading challenges or challenges with mathematics their struggles are being completely dismissed in favor of this privileged pet project of ethnic studies. This is a pet project of privileged academics.
Exactly. White adjacent. Going back to the thing about there are these four priority ethnicities named as African American, Latino, Asian American, and Native American. By doing this, they're marginalizing everyone. I mean, they literally, whether you fall within or beyond these classifications, it's marginalizing you, pigeonholing you, putting it in a box, and even forcing, multiracial children, literally to pit their own parent heritages against each other, and they have to pick a side. And it's also interesting to point out that in these four groups, Jews are not in it, but neither are Arabs. Which may or may not be deliberate. So I'm curious, because you raised the point, which is very cogent, that the Black children are also suffering. Are we seeing other groups besides Jewish groups? It actually, I know that CARE it has raised flags over this framework. What about the priority groups? Like, are they totally on board? I put it in air quotes. The priority groups, are they totally on board with the way that they are like being portrayed, for example?
One, the four ethnic groups that are mentioned in the model curriculum aren't necessarily included in the ethnic studies curricula that's being taught in school districts. So I want to put that out there. People think are assuming that an ethnic studies class is going to cover those four groups in equal measures of weeks or over the course of a semester or a year, or whatever the district has mandated. That's not happening. You look at the units, and they're about identity. They're thematic. So they're not even necessarily covering the history and the experiences of those four groups. And then the ones that are covering those groups as a monolith. So mm-hmm. if they present material on Black Americans, they're presenting only a specific Black American communities that fit an ideological agenda. And so again, that reinforces stereotypes about Black Americans. If people really wanted more ethnically, racially, experientially diverse history, then that's all we need to do. We don't need to import some other discipline that has not been proven to actually provide any level of scholarly rigor or benefit students.
Right. I mean, we're forcing the entire world into one of two boxes, as if the world is that binary, that either you're an oppressor or an oppressed, and there's no one in the middle, or that's just living life.
Yeah. I mean, it's also ignoring the fact that everybody at some point, or most people at some point, hold power and privilege, and there are instances where they don't. I mean, right now, today, we all have the privilege of being alive. To pretend that because of somebody's racial identity or ethnic identity, they can only ever feel either privileged or oppressed is nonsensical.
Of course it is. And it's more than that, because, again, as we said before, like, if you want public sympathy, you better be oppressed. So I'm not sure how this empowers minorities that the system feigns to serve. I mean, for example, and again, you alluded to this earlier, but instead of telling, like, our Black students the like 1619 story, that they're oppressed and will always be oppressed because we live in an untenable, systematically racist society, wouldn't it make more sense to focus on Barack Obama or Kamala Harris or Oprah Winfrey or LeBron James to show what is possible when you work hard and aim high? And in like,
I mean, I don't think necessarily so. To me, if you're going to tell a story, you tell all of it. So you tell the good, the bad, and the ugly. You don't do just one or the other. And I think that the problem right now that we see, especially in a lot of K through 12 content, is there's one story and one narrative being told. And usually when that's done, it's because there's a specific agenda or conclusion that the teacher or the educator is trying to get students to, versus informing them about the good, the bad, and the ugly, because there has been all three. In the history and present of the United States of America, there's been all three. There are wonderful things. There are horrible things. There are ugly things that have happened in our country's history. None of it should be ignored if we're raising the next generation of citizens.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Because again, life is nuanced. We don't live in these simplistic dichotomies. But let me contrast that then. And I fully understand and agree. Like, we have to show the full picture of reality, the full tapestry of what's going on, not just to these four groups, but to everyone. But here's the irony. So wherein the messaging is so heavily dependent on these four groups as being oppressed or whatever, and the Jewish people are intractably being characterized as privileged, completely, let's go back to history, it completely ignores the fact that the vast predominance of Jewish immigrants who arrived in America came here like with nothing but the shirts on their backs. The Jewish people were also on the signs that said, no Jews, no blacks, no dogs, not selling that order. And these are policies that you know, went all the way into the mid 20th century. I might even argue they still exist in certain parts of the South. So ultimately, like, the current manifestation of anti-Semitism seems to be an upshot of Jews being resented for rising from the ashes instead of wallowing in them. So given these parallels, let's say we both came from the ashes. Why are the approaches to presenting the Black and Jewish experiences in such blatant juxtaposition? Because as we said, like, there have been some very outsized successes, even within the Black community. I just named four of them.
And those have been erased.
Yeah.
So with the discipline of ethnic studies, those successes have been erased. So what we're seeing is revisionist history, a rewriting of history to portray each of these groups, each of these racial groups, each of these ethnic groups, to portray them in a way that fits a specific agenda. So if we think of the history of any, we'll pick any racial group in America, those individuals that make up those groups have achieved successes and they faced obstacles. We can go through many of them. If we want to talk about Black Americans, we can do that. Those successes have been erased. The people that fought to achieve those successes have either been erased or demonized under this like oppression, Olympics, oppression, binary discipline of ethnic studies. So that when I say this isn't, it's not just that it's bad for Jewish Americans, this is bad for Black America, it's bad for all American kids. But if we're talking about Black American kids, well, now the history of the racial or ethnic communities that they may come from is being completely rewritten or erased. And if the purpose of ethnic studies is to tell the story and teach about groups that have been ignored or marginalized in the past, well, ethnic studies seems to be continuing in that pattern.
Right. And so let me ask you about the erasure or reframing of the father of modern, like, civil rights in America, like Martin Luther King Jr., his entire vision. And I discussed this at length with Coleman Hughes, who, you know, is a true anti-racist. What happened to this vision of, they hold him up as their hero, but his entire message was that people should be judged by the strength of their character rather than the color of their skin. So is this another example of historical erasure or revisionism? Because I don't see them throwing that baby out with the bathwater. They still love the guy.
Not necessarily. So many of the ethnic studies activists have actually labeled Dr. King as being like insufficiently revolutionary.
Wow.
Okay. As too passive. There are the people that don't fit the ideology get ignored or erased.
Is this, so going back to the oppression Olympics, I mean, these are mental gymnastics that are impossible to win, aren't they? Because we're presented with this paradigm. As you said, it's a race to the bottom, right? And like, I could say, like, I know that I speak for the Jewish people in general when I say that though we've been deeply oppressed, we've also overcome and risen to like unparalleled levels of success. We don't want to be labeled as the oppressed, even if we have been. And at the same time, we're not oppressors and we don't deserve to be labeled as that. And so, like, again, like, these oppression Olympics cannot be won.
Like, the only way to win it is to agree to not play the game.
Yes.
It is, we are in an upside down world when we want to teach children to strive to be seen as weak and incapable and disempowered. That is, and those are values that for most, at least of human history, people would push against. I can't think of my grandfather, who was born in Jim Crow, Mississippi in 1926 in a house with a dirt floor, wanting me, his oldest granddaughter, to learn that I could never achieve anything because everything is stacked against me because the United States is so institutionally racist I can never achieve. That is the upside down. There's no way that makes sense. And I think, unfortunately, the misunderstanding that our elected officials have about what this subject is fueling the upside down ideology.
Exactly. And the I think that rather than trying to figure out where we are, we humans, it doesn't matter, name the group, are on the spectrum of, again, of oppressor to oppress. Instead of that, we need to get rid of that spectrum and start working in a framework of, as humans, how do we move forward in like a better space. Something I'm going to be honest, I don't fully understand, and I hope that you'll be able to shed some light on, is Donald Trump. I could end the sentence there, but I'll keep going. So he's technically, he's outlawed DEI, at least in the government. How that ban can or can't and is or isn't being enforced is another topic. And now he's dismantling the Department of Education. So I could be very wrong. I could be very wrong, but it seems like the DOE is the only chance we have right now at ensuring that CRT-based or critical theory, as you'd say, based ethnic studies are not taught in schools. I know that Trump would definitely be against that, but by handing everything back to the states, excuse me. What does the future of K through 12 education look like in light of these two dynamics? Like, will the middle of the country be like, yes, no ethnic studies, no DEI, no, Marxism, no anything, and then we just see, like, just in the blue wall, we see this dominant ethnic studies that's only going to divide our country further and further into the corners that we're already polarized into.
I mean, I think there are other tools that can be used, not just through the federal level Department of Education. But before I talk about that, I also want to mention that most, like significantly most funding, all curriculum, those are decided at the state level anyway,
Okay.
or the district level. So the U.S. Department of Education has very little to do with what your kids are learning in their K through 12 classroom. That's why it's so important to pay attention to who's on your school board or who's running for school board, or possibly even throw your hat in the ring and run for your school board. That's why it's so important to pay attention to who's going to be, whether it's an elected position or an appointed position, who's your state secretary of education. That's where most K through 12, everything lies, and definitely for curriculum and what your kids are learning in the classroom, that's decided at the state and local level already.
I think that what's interesting to me, Brandy, is something that I maybe my biggest takeaway from all this that I've never even thought about is, I think in terms of legislation, I guess that's naive. You're talking in terms of funding.
No, not for everything, but for a lot of things. Definitely for legislation. The group of people who mandated, who made ethnic studies a requirement to graduate high school in California didn't happen in DC. That happened in Sacramento.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. When we talk about the school districts, you mentioned Santa Ana, the people who decided to bring in the anti-Jewish group to provide teacher training and curriculum development, that was at the district level. That wasn't decided in DC.
But there can't be national standards that, no.
No, K through 12 education now is decided at the local and state level. However, the national standard of civil rights and non-discrimination, that comes from in DC. And whether that's handled at the DOE or the DOJ or some other organization has yet to be seen. That's not my decision to make. But regardless, we still have civil rights laws, and civil rights laws in the United States apply to everyone. Right. They don't only apply to minority groups or only groups that are deemed sufficiently oppressed. Civil rights are for every American.
Okay, good to know. So our federal government has not as much impact as local government, but you know whose federal government does? Qatar. Qatar. So a couple of weeks ago, obviously, there was this big bombshell about Brown University, who has taken Qatari money to put very overtly anti-Israel, anti-Zionistic, anti-Semitic ethnic studies curricula into 8,000 U.S. schools in all 50 states. So by now, I think everyone's aware of the depth and impact of Qatari money in our universities, but now we're proving a direct correlation to K-12 as well. So when our kids are being indoctrinated to hate Jews and the Jewish state, literally since preschool, what does this mean for the future of our nation as a refuge for the Jewish people and for the historically unbreakable ties between the United States and Israel? I mean, look at Gaza. These kids are fed anti-Semitism with their mother's milk. And now here in America, we are going to have generations of jihadis whose primary purpose in life is to destroy Jewish values, Christian values, American values. It seems like deprogramming them is going to be a task so monumental. It will take, even if we got rid of it within 5 years, and I think that'd be a very short timeline. We're talking about something that is so entrenched right now and such a hot topic, but I think it will take at least two generations to deprogram, because as I said, like I can literally see the parents of the kids I know being programmed along with their children. So is the United States going to head down the same sort of like jihadi road that Gaza is, because their children are being taught this stuff from birth?
I don't think so. And I want to say the reason I say that, not to be toxically positive, but I do want to point out that most people reject that. Most kids are rejecting this ideology. Now, that doesn't mean that it isn't a fight and that it isn't serious, because most isn't all. And we have people, and we've seen the result of it, the people that are ingesting and anti-Jewish, anti-American ideology, we see them get positions, whether elected positions in the halls of Congress or whether positions over our art sphere, so which movies get made and nominated for awards and promoted, which ones don't. And we see those people in those positions and using that huge stage to gin up more hate and more bigotry and more discrimination. So it's still dangerous and still needs to be managed and handled. And most kids aren't buying what the radicals are selling. I'm sorry.
You have statistics on that?
No, I don't have statistics on it. What I can see is that the folks that I know that live in places that are very maybe left-leaning have a different concern level, a higher concern level, because what they're seeing is heightened in a hyper state, and it's real. They're not exaggerating. It is very real in certain segments of our country. And it's also very true that our country has regional culture, and some of those regions reject that. And yeah, that we are seeing. It's really easy. I'm born and raised in Southern California. I live in Pennsylvania now. So I live in a wonderful, wonderfully purple state now, which is fantastic to see. It doesn't mean it isn't a problem in pockets here, but we can see where and how it's coming into the classroom and who's ingesting it and who's rejecting it. And also in the United States, I mean, we have a pretty good firewall against it. There are many, many Americans who love our country, want to work really hard and dedicate their lives to improving our country and working on the things that need to be worked on and improved, and who are figuring out who to partner with to do it. I think one of the things we've seen overall in the American Jewish community is the American Jewish community, by and large, has been politically, ideologically homogenous. And that political ideology, ideological bubble is not the one that has been welcoming us in current years. And so there's a little bit of disconnect, like identity crisis, to wait, where do we fit in? I'd written an article months ago about, you know, will American Jews become politically homeless? Mm-hmm. And it hits on this idea, because the spaces that a significant portion of American Jewry felt comfortable with, either politically or ideologically, has been the group that those groups have been the ones that have been fomenting a lot of the anti-Jewish bigotry that we've seen in recent months, recent years.
Yeah. Okay, we're running low on time, so I do want to get into tooting your horn a little bit here.
No, let's not do that.
Yeah, just a little bit. Okay, so you're involved, your organization that you're involved in, one of many, NAVI, which is the North American Values Institute, is part of, as you have already touched upon, the Coalition for Empowered Education. You created your, not you, Brandy, but as a group, have created your own empowered, I love that word, because it's true that what's going on right now is so disempowering, ethnic studies curricula as an alternative to what you would term liberated ethnic studies. Now, I have a problem with the word liberated, because I think that what's being called liberal these days is highly illiberal. Nonetheless, so your coursework, E Pluribus Unum, right, focuses on increasing, like, actually what people would like to think ethnic studies is about, which is increasing awareness and appreciation of others in order to foster a more tolerant and pluralistic society. So how dramatically different is your content from what you are currently seeing taught in schools?
So the content that we created is, I think, what most people, most parents would think of when they hear ethnic studies. I think it's what most parents would think, yeah, we want our kids to learn this content. It's based in the discipline of history or social studies that most of us experienced when we went to school, when we were in high school. So we don't really deviate from that as a discipline to bring in an ideological agenda that foments division and bigotry and fuels stereotypes. We look at, okay, these are some experiences and stories and facts that have been part of American history and American culture that maybe some kids haven't learned yet. So let's give them an opportunity to learn it.
Okay, I have a weird question. Given how we started and the framework of what ethnic studies is this ethnic studies, or is this like a new form of history class?
So interesting you say that. It could be both, according to what parameters have been laid out by the state of California for what ethnic studies needs to be. So it meets the mandate that the state of California is requiring kids to learn in order to earn their high school diploma. Mm-hmm. But our method and our pedagogy isn't rooted in the oppression binary that the discipline of ethnic studies is rooted in. It's not dependent on critical theory concepts.
But you use the same for focus groups.
Right. So part of the mandate of the ethnic ethnic studies mandate is that those groups need to be covered.
So how do you address Judaism and or Israel?
Well, Israel isn't in there because this is supposed to be an American class. It's supposed to focus on the United States of America. So we do have lessons there that, for lack of a better word, intersect. We talk about redlining, and redlining impacted Black Americans and Jewish Americans. We talk about the partnership between the Rosenwald schools and then but the partnership between Black and Jewish Americans through the Rosenwald schools and through HBCUs. So those stories and those lessons are taught. We also are collecting a repository of lessons on other minority groups, because we know that those four groups that came about in the ethnic studies movement 50 years ago aren't representative of the demographics that make up our student body today. So we know that there, you know, we're including lessons on Hindu Americans and on Korean Americans, those specific groups that now make up a huge part of the demographic of California. And the benefit of the Coalition for Empowered Education is one of the things that we can do is bring on more lessons tailored to a school district. If a district wants to beef up their American history class that most kids take in 11th grade, well, they can use lessons from our curriculum.
I love it. So what kind of response has the curriculum like received? Like, have there both like endorsements and rejections? Like, is there a demand for kinder, gentler ethnic studies?
What's been fascinating about this whole debacle and debate over the past few years is how many administrators and teachers don't want to be in an ideological fight. They just want to be able to provide the resources and tools necessary to help kids learn. So those folks have been looking for something like this. They've welcomed it with open arms. The more radical groups of folks have slandered and smeared and done, I think, what most people would expect, because they are, have an agenda that runs counter to improve student learning and outcomes, and honestly runs counter to healthy learning environments.
I agree. And if we were to go back to like the actual basics of education, right? Like I got this from one of your conversations about like the three R's, right? It used to be that this was the basis of like a functional literate society, right? Like reading, writing, and arithmetic. Of course, only two of which are actual R's. And I know that because I had a really good education growing up and it was very comprehensive. It wasn't replaced with things like ethnic studies. But now the three R's are race, radicalization, and revolution. And it used to be that a teacher's role was to educate students with objective content and foster independent thinking. But now it seems like their goal is to serve this sort of like,
it's like a political agenda.
I was going to use the word deliberately though, right? Like it seems deliberately political in that they're seeking to create social activists instead of independent thinkers or even tolerant little humans.
It seems that way. And I will say that I think that one of the things that we didn't touch on today, but maybe at another time, this is what future educators are actually being taught in schools of education or departments of education. They're being taught that, well, all education is political. They're being taught to do things like YPAR, which focuses on youth activism. So entire lessons are around how to get kids involved in social action, what they call social action, teaching them how to demonstrate and protest. And not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that in itself. I mean, this is America. We were founded on one of the biggest protests that started, you know, our country was founded on with the rejection of the taxes and everything in Boston. But I think we need to remember is that time spent on teaching kids to protest is time not being spent on teaching them how to read.
And there's constructive protest and destructive protest, right?
Exactly.
Okay, Brandy, I have to end on a high note. Where's the hope here?
One of the biggest things that gives me hope is the involvement of everybody. We've seen parents with their eyes opened and very, very determined to make sure that our education system does right by our future generation.
Awesome. And how can people find you? And what would you say are the most important documents that they should be accessing online to educate themselves about this situation, whether it's articles or your model curriculum, anything? I'll put the links in the show notes.
So they can go to NaviValues.org and see what the North American Values Institute is doing. One of my colleagues there, Dr. Mika Hackner, has authored wonderful, wonderful articles on Substack that really highlight a lot of the things that we've uncovered that the research she's done has found happening in districts across the country. And so that's a K-12 tracker on Substack. And you can follow the Alliance for Constructive Ethnic Studies that has been in this fight for years, focused in California, public and private schools. And of course, you can look up the Coalition for Empowered Education.
Okay. I'm just writing that down. That was a very comprehensive and unselfish way of saying Brandy's social media links are in the show notes. Please follow her as well. Brandy, what a pleasure and what a tremendously educational discussion this has been. Even for me, who knows everything. No, for me, but also I'm sure for everybody who's had the pleasure of tuning in. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's an honor. Thank you.